What kid growing up didn't dream of having some secret language that only a few people could understand? Now, Jeff, I got to pick your brain. When we were growing up, and for some reason, I have some picture of us making up some language. Did we ever try to make up some language as kids?
I don't know if we did. I mean, we had our, secret bird calls in the woods and things to
Oh,
communicate
yeah. Go,
things.
go, go, go. I remember
Yeah,
that one.
yeah,
Yeah, but that's
yeah.
not the
And
same.
no, it's not. And I did have dreams of us like learning an obscure language together, like Navajo or something, so that we could talk and our parents couldn't understand what we were saying.
The only languages I remember, there was Pig Latin, of course, that
Oh
every
yeah.
kid thought, yeah, you know, like,
Oh
oh,
yeah.
I know Pig Latin now. Oh, I'm like a Mensa whatever genius. And then, do you remember Ubby Dubby language from the TV show Zoom?
From Zoom, yeah, I called it
Yeah.
double Dutch. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was like whatever, every like you'd say the consonant and you'd have to say Ubby
You
afterwards or something, right?
put I think you put ub in front of every vowel. So if like your name Darren would be Deberabin.
Oh, see, that's why I didn't understand it because I never could get the hang of that.
Deberabin.
Everybody wants to have some learn some cool language or create some cool language. But the real truth is, there are very small groups all around the world who have very unique languages, which sort of might seem cool, but there presents some problems. So how do you serve those people? How do you find them? How do you help them preserve the information that they need? How do you get information to them? That is exactly what we're going to be talking about today. Welcome to the Voice Box. I'm Darren.
And I'm Jeff. Today we're talking to Dan Whitenack of SIL. And Dan, can you tell us what SIL is all about and what you're doing to explore, learn, preserve, and support languages around the world?
Sure. Thank you. Thank you both so much for having me on the podcast. It's really great to be here. SIL International is an international NGO, and currently SIL is working in over 100 countries. We have about 1,300 or so language projects going on at any given time. And for those that don't know, there's currently 7,139 languages being spoken today around the world.
No, wait a
That's
minute, wait a
pretty.
minute, wait a minute. See, in my mind, the world is like becoming homogenous, and there's only like two or three languages that anybody speaks, and all these forgotten languages are getting forgotten about. But literally, more than 7,000 languages?
More
Does
than
that count?
7,000 languages, and a
Does
lot of
that count
those.
Pig Latin or double Dutch?
And the Ubby
I
Dubby
don't
is.
know if that technically counts those, but this is but the 7,000 number, it is actively spoken languages, not like extinct languages or something like that. Those are actually being spoken in the world today, and it's actually even more than that if you consider things like the 400 sign languages that are being spoken around the world currently as well. So there's extreme language diversity, and even in places like Indonesia, for example, and in an individual country in Indonesia, there's over 700 languages spoken.
And I just want to get the number right. You said, was it 7,139? Was that the number that you?
7,139. And if people want to explore a little bit about those languages, they can go to ethnologue.com, which is a site that that SIL supports, and you can go through and look through various visualizations of languages and all of that sort of thing.
So I got to figure out what exactly are you guys doing now? You're going to those communities where it's one of the not one of the top 20 languages. It wasn't one that what somebody learned in high school, like German, French, English, Spanish, whatever. But you're going to those little places, and once you get there, what do you do?
If you think about language, it basically touches every part of your life, right? Everything you do has something to do with language. And so SIL's desire, their vision is to see local language communities flourishing with the languages that they value most. So what does flourishing mean? Well, flourish means partly having access to education, learning, knowledge. Partly it means interacting with your community, engaging with things like, community events and religious services and all of those things. It also means engaging with the wider world, right? Having access to things on the internet, for example, or using technologies that we benefit from because we speak English or another high resource language. And so SIL is involved in some way and in all aspects of that life flourishing. And that involves things like, you know, translation of content. That might be something people think of first off, but other things as well. If you think about like your phone, your phone's keyboard supports English, right? Does it support all these other languages? So SIL is involved in, you know, technology projects to help support languages and keyboards, to help publish writing system scripts, and is involved in Unicode standards and other things, is involved in mapping out where languages actually are spoken. And also a big one is community or early childhood education, multilingual education and literacy. So this is a really interesting fact that, you know, if you imagine being a kid in one of these language communities and you speak this your language at home, all your family speaks your language, all your community speaks your language, and then you go to school and they say, you can't use that language. You have to use this other language. Well, what did that do? It doesn't make school very much fun, right? And it's actually been proven that that stunts a person's educational potential moving forward. So it's really important that things like education consider local language, and SIL is involved in those educational efforts as well.
Just so you know, Daniel, I spoke the same language at school at home, and school still was not very much fun for me. So I would imagine throwing the language thing there like makes it even worse. So when you go into a community, What do you guys do? Do you sit down with people? Do you have them, do you capture them speaking, and do you translate that or document that or whatever? Or what are the actual real practical things when someone goes Sure. into a community and sits down with people?
Can I jump in and ask, can you give us, so that we're not talking in the abstract, can you give us an example of a language that you might be personally familiar with where SIL has done some work, and so we can talk about a specific concrete language.
Yeah, sure. So recently we did a machine translation project with Central Siberian Yupik. So Central Siberian Yupik, it's spoken by about 12 or 1300 people. And so it's what we would consider a low resource language in the AI world, which is the world I'm in on the technical side. And what that means is that it doesn't have the sort of huge set of resources that are associated with other languages like English in terms of representation of content on the internet, or books available in that language, or like software applications that support that language. All of those resources are sort of not present for Central Siberian Yupik for the most part. So that's an example community. And to your point, Darren, in terms of making things concrete, it really depends on what the community itself desires and needs. So SIL isn't an organization, or at least we very much try not to be an organization that goes into a community like from the West and says, here's what you need, you local language speakers. That's not what we desire. What we desire is to be a resource in those communities to say, you know, where are you trying to use your language? What problems are you having? How can we help achieve greater development for your language or greater access to educational material? And so it really depends on what the community needs. But let's say it is translation. So, you know, recently with COVID hitting, a lot of language communities needed health information, right? And so a concrete example is SIL is very involved in helping get health information about COVID-19 into as many local languages as we could, such that people could understand, what is COVID-19? How should I behave? What does proper hand washing mean? All of these sorts of things. You would think everybody would just have equal access to those things, but the reality is billions of people around the world just don't, because of the language that they speak or because of where they're at.
Can I ask, let's get back to Central Siberian Yupik. That's Y-U-P-I-K, K, right?
Yes, that's correct.
I thought it was like when you go to the cherry orchards and it's like cherries, no. You pick, you know.
No, you pick. We have some of that in Indiana, yeah.
Okay, sorry. I had the wrong image in my mind. There are all these people in central Siberia out picking fruit or something. Okay, sorry, get back to the question.
Well, so I'm trying to come to terms with the idea that there's a language that has roughly 1,000 speakers. And that you were doing a machine translation project with them. So first of all, that implies they do have a written language.
Yeah, that's a really great question. So there's a few different interesting layers of complication here, right? One is data scarcity, which you alluded to. Hey, if there aren't that many resources in Central Siberia and Yupik, where do we start? How do we do anything, especially with something like machine translation? But then there's other layers of complexity, right? This is a language. It's documented. It exists. Is it written? And if it's written, how is it written? And that's what we call a writing system script. So there's also a huge variety of writing system scripts around the world. And some languages use multiple, right? So some languages can be written, for example, in Cyrillic and Latin characters. So for the project, we use the writing system script of Latin characters for Central Siberian Yupik. So they do have a written language. And part of some of the work that SIL does around the world is actually helping communities develop a writing system because they might not have ever written down their language. But in this case, there is a written language. And the interesting thing that we did in this case was we leveraged the fact that languages are, even though they're the distinct, they're related in families, right? And there's another language family called Inuktitut, which is an Inuit family of languages. And there's a bunch of data but a bunch more data for that language than there is for Central Siberian Yupik. And so we used this machine translation and AI kind of trick, if you like, called transfer learning, where we started with another language that had more resources and we tried to transfer that knowledge into this lower resource language for the machine translation.
So is Central Siberian Yupik and Inuktitut, am I saying that right?
That was right. You nailed it.
Oh, man. All right. Are they like in the same language family? Are they related? Or are you doing the transfer learning across unrelated families?
Yeah, so they are related. They're all part of this sort of Inuit languages. And you can actually explore on that website that I mentioned, the ethnologue. There's actually, if you think about it sort of like a tree or a family tree, just like a family tree of our ancestry, right? There are sort of larger families of languages with individual languages under those and then dialects under those. And so these do share some of those same characteristics. So the idea is that even though they're different, they're not like one group can't really understand what the other group is saying. Their grammar, their syntax, some characteristics of the language are similar enough that you can learn something from one language and sort of transfer it over and reuse that knowledge when you're doing something for the second language.
And the other question I had is that for a problem like machine translation for Central Siberian Yupik, if that's going to be a machine learning kind of approach, you need a sizable corpus of data. I guess the transfer learning addresses that a little bit, but it feels to me like with 1,000 speakers of the language, you kind of have to get every single person to give you everything they've ever written in order to train any kind of, you know, and learn any kind of a translation system there. That must be a challenge.
Yeah, it is a challenge. And I think there's also, were some technology like this to be utilized with the community, it would definitely need to be a sort of human in the loop thing, right?
Yeah.
And that's one thing that, I emphasized earlier that we're not just creating technology and other things that is totally separate from communities. I think its use within the community has to be evaluated as we develop these things. And in this case, maybe it's an aid to people translating new material into Yupik. And the machine translation is used as a sort of first draft or something like that, that can help them do the translation faster. And also maybe in that process, it helps engage people with their language and they learn more about their language and they use it more and more. And so maybe it develops sort of fostering of flourishing with that language. That's ultimately what we would desire in that sort of scenario.
Great. Daniel, where's the most remote place you have been? You probably don't go as, maybe there are people who do more, but where's the strangest, smallest, most remote place that you've been to study a language?
Well, interestingly, I have been a few places. I must admit that I am not a linguist myself. I'm a computer person. I'm a data scientist. And so when I'm going to study a language, most of the time, the language I'm primarily working in is like Python or Go or another programming language. But I have visited communities and interacted with people. I've been to India a few times to different communities there. I've also been to Siberia, which was a fun experience, and experienced my, you know, negative 40 degree night and all of that. And so, yeah, it's really cool to see these communities. And I think one of the really cool things to me, which I didn't realize growing up in the background that I grew up in, is that there's just so much. So it's not that we want to get all of our Western information into these languages so that people can benefit from the West. These communities are really vibrant communities that have a lot to offer us, right? Maybe they have a different understanding in their language of different topics. And when they express those to us, when they communicate the information and the knowledge that their community has back to us, it is really valuable, and we'd love to get that out. So it's a two-way sort of thing that is really desired, I think.
And of the 7,139 languages that you guys have documented, what is the smallest group of those language where the smallest number of people speak that language? Any idea what that number might be?
So I think that there's a lot of languages. So there's a lot of languages that are sort of documented of having like 500 or fewer speakers. And one thing to realize is that when we do language survey, you know, it's really hard to pinpoint like 527 or something like that. So when you get into these lower numbers, sometimes we're just represented, it's around 500 or something like that. And there's a lot of those languages. In particular, SIL has done a lot of work in Papua New Guinea. I'm just looking up here, try to get a couple languages, but Papua New Guinea has extreme language diversity. That's one of the places that SIL has worked a whole lot. If you look there, let's see. Just trying to get the information.
While you're looking there, Dan, I'm just going to tell you, somehow you got the short end of the stick. They have people in Papua New Guinea, and instead you're going to 40 degrees below in Siberia. You got the wrong assignment there. New Guinea, I'm thinking, is a little bit more enjoyable on the beach than Siberia with 40 degrees below at night.
Yeah, you know, I would really love to go to Papua New Guinea at some point because there's such language diversity there, SIL has a big presence, similar to places like in Africa and other places. And the sort of SIL campus in Papua New Guinea, I've heard, is bigger than the headquarters, which is in Dallas, Texas, which is kind of funny. SIL has turned into a very sort of distributed group of people. I'm looking at here. So like, you know, I'm just looking through the languages of Papua New Guinea. There's Abu, which is, spoken in sort of 22 towns and has 4,200, users. There's, Adazera, 30,000 users, Aka, 3,400. So there's just a huge diversity there. And also there's dialects. There's also like pidgin languages and creoles, which are very interesting. And I think those have a lot of interesting characteristics for use in computational methods because they are very related to other languages. But yeah.
Okay, Dan, if we, our final question we always ask everybody, if we had like a genie in a box, because it's the voice box, if we had a genie in a box and you could open that box and the genie's going to grant you any wish that you want that could help you with what you're doing, anything pop into your mind? What kind of technology, what kind of solution, what kind of, you know, speech voice thing you're like, oh, I wish we could do fill in the blank. What would it be? What would you ask the genie?
Yeah, that's such a wonderful question. I think, you know, so mine's pretty aspirational, I think. We'll say it's that. But if you look at the graph of, so if we think about dialogue and speech-related methods that support things like chatbots or our Alexa or, you know, natural language processing in your word processor that does like autocomplete or, you know, spell check and all of those things. If you look at the graphs of language support for those technologies, even, you know, it's mostly 100 languages or fewer. And if you think about that in with respect to the 7,000 plus languages in the world, that's not that great of support. And so I think any one of those technologies, whether it's speech recognition or named entity recognition or sentiment analysis, if I was to sort of make a wish, I would wish that those building block technologies that we sort of take for granted because they're the under the hood of our autocomplete or they're under the hood of our Alexa, those building block AI technologies would have support for even the next, if we push it even to the next 200 or 300 languages. That's a huge population of the world's population that gets such a benefit in their flourishing with their language. So that's my wish is those building block AI technologies would add that language support and keep growing and increase in momentum in the languages that they support over time.
Love it. Great wish. I'm glad you chose that. By the way, go back to the list that has the 7,139. Make sure you add Pig Latin and Ubby Dubby language, and we're going to get it up to 7,141. Okay.
Sounds good. Yeah, hey, Dan, sounds good.
Thanks so much for joining us today and sharing all the insight about what you're doing to really, really make an impact in the world. Thanks again.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
So Jeff, I loved hearing what Daniel and SIL are doing, but I got more excited watching you because you got excited listening to them. So as you were hearing some of the stuff that he was talking about, what started the wheels turning in your mind? What got you excited?
People often ask me, where do I think voice needs to go next? And this is at the top of my list is we need to bring the technology to make it accessible to everyone. We don't have that problem with a lot of other technology. When someone builds a car or some other general technology, anyone in the world can use it. But voice technology is only usable by the people who speak the half a dozen or 10 or in some cases, you know, 70 or 80 languages that are supported for, and it goes to anything that's so dependent on language. And this is, pushing language technology out into the place where there's this long tail of all the languages of the world that people that people speak as their first language and sometimes their only language. And they are not able to participate in the economy and the social systems of the world. We talk about globalization and shrinking of borders, but there's this language barrier that is there for so many people. I got to tell you a story, something that we've been doing at Cobalt Speech and Language that's related to what Dan was talking about. There's a group at our alma mater, Darren, Brigham Young University, who is collecting stories from Cambodians who have survived the Khmer Rouge and others. But there's this Cambodian oral history project that I just learned about a year ago and I'm passionate about and I'm supportive of. And in fact, we reached out to them and said, can we help you transcribe these oral histories? And we have been working with them on a project to build Cambodian speech recognition from the histories that they've already recorded and transcribed to help transcribe further further things. But Cambodian is one of these examples of languages that it's a major language. It's spoken by millions of people, but it is not it's not well supported by most of the technology that's out there these days. And so we're in a project right now. It's a sort of pro bono project that we're doing with the Cambodian Oral History Project to develop Cambodian speech recognition. And I hope when it's done that it'll be not just used for transcribing oral histories, but also people in Cambodia and Cambodians around the world will be able to, you know, talk to Siri or Alexa or whatever to be able to do the same things the rest of us do.
There are millions of people that speak that language that don't have access to the same speech and voice services that the rest of the world does. And that's just one language. Because then, as you mentioned, like, oh, well, there are probably lots of other languages that are, you know, millions of people speak that they don't have those same systems. So little by little, we'll chip away at it and get it. You mentioned our alma mater. How would you say rise and shout in Abu Dhabi language? Is that Rabais Baban Shabout, or how is that?
That's pretty close. Yeah. That's our school fight song.
Yes. Well, thank everybody for joining us on the Babois Babox. No, yeah, how do you say it?
Yeah. Is that it? The Babois Babox.
Okay. That thing. I gotta work on my Abu Dhabi language. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for joining us. I'm Darren.
And I'm Jeff, and we'll see you next time.